Silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I'm delighted to welcome to this oral argument several high school students and others. First, Albany High School students, would they stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Conserve School, is that a high school too?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Thank you for coming.
Milton
High School. They are watching this proceeding in room 411 South through our video system here. And I want you all to stand, even though we cannot see. And thank you all for coming, and you too may be seated. We'll give them a couple of seconds to be seated quietly. We also have some special guests, and they are guests from the Oneida Tribal Courts, and they are the judicial staff of that court. If they would please stand and be recognized. Thank you all for coming. The students are here with our program called Court with Class. And that program is designed to be part of the broader civics education of students. We invite students from all over the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If they come, they're given the briefs of the case that they are to hear, and they may engage in some activities relating to that case. They come to the oral argument, and then they will meet with a justice of this court after this second oral argument. The discussion will be the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues that we are going to hear. And these meetings are open to all of you, whether you're a student or not. So we are delighted to have you all, and we hope you can stay, and you might be joined by other students. You might not be. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Rogensack, and she's the justice who will meet with you at noon. And on the far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case, 04AP3239, Wisconsin Department of Revenue versus Menasha Corporation. Representing the state of Wisconsin is F. Thomas Creeran, the third, and you may proceed.
Please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Thomas Creeran, and I represent the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. The outcome of this case depends entirely upon the application of an administrative rule promulgated by the department. That rule determines whether or not a software sale by a software vendor is subject to sales and use tax. The department's rule contains provisions that are used to determine whether the essence of the transaction between the software purchaser and the software vendor involves a taxable sale of tangible personal property or a non-taxable sale of services. This particular case involves SAP's sale of the same approximately 70 software modules that it had previously sold thousands of times before this particular sale to Menasha in 1995. In this case, the department provided the Wisconsin Tax Appeals Commission with 8 published private letter rulings and 2 published tax releases explaining how the department had previously construed and applied the provisions in the rule that the department had promulgated in fact situations similar to and relevant to this case. The 3 most pertinent published rulings are the one at pages 153 through 155 of our appendix, the one in example 8 at pages 220 to 221 of our appendix, and the one in example 7 at page 226 of our appendix. In its decision in this case, the Tax Appeals Commission construed and applied the provisions of the department's rule for the very first time. The commission's decision construed those provisions without even mentioning any of the department's prior published constructions of the department's rule. The commission's first time construction of the department's rule in this case directly conflicts with the way that the department had construed the rule that the department promulgated in the department's published constructions of that rule.
Counsel, when we look at the question of deference, to whom should we be looking? Should we be looking at the Department of Revenue, or should we be looking at the Tax Appeals Commission?
In this case, what's involved is an administrative rule. And the department promulgated that rule as a quasi-legislative agency. And this, the court's other decisions involving the construction of administrative rules indicate that the deference, if it is appropriate, is granted to the agency that promulgated the rule as part of that quasi-legislative process. But even if you say that there's a quasi-judicial decision here and that we're going to look to the way the commission construed the rule, I don't think that entitles the commission to ignore the way that the department construed the rule and its prior published constructions of that rule.
Well, this court had 2 decisions from last term. One was the Harley-Davidson decision, the other was Daimler-Chrysler. And how do you get around those decisions and say that the deference should be to the Department of Revenue rather than to the Tax Appeals Commission?
Well, in Daimler-Chrysler, which probably is, I would say, the more pertinent of the 2 decisions, there was no indication that the quasi-judicial agency's construction of the rule was contrary in any way to the Department of Workforce Development's construction of the rule that the Department of Workforce Development had promulgated. Here, there is a contrast, and in fact, the constructions are diametrically opposed. The commission's construction is diametrically opposed to the way that the department had construed the rule.
And I think there has to be a conflict before we would give deference to the Tax Appeals Commission.
I think that at a minimum, you do not give deference to the Tax Appeals Commission if it fails to consider, after having been advised, of the department's official published constructions of its rule. If you don't do that, if that is never done, that's never been done anywhere in this case. It's never been done by the commission. It's never been done by the Court of Appeals. And even in this court, Menasha never discusses the department's published constructions of the rule that the department promulgated.
And
now, at some point, those have to be addressed.
You're saying there was indeed a conflict here.
Yes.
Between the Department of Revenue and the Tax Appeals Commission. And in Daimler-Chrysler, as I understand your argument, you're saying there was no conflict between the interpretation and the DWD's position.
And I don't think there's any suggestion. I mean, there's there seems to be at least a suggestion in that case that the that Lurk's construction of DWD's rule was consistent with DWD's construction. And
Counselor, if we defer to DOR, then doesn't the Tax Appeals Commission lose some of its authority to be the final decision maker on tax questions?
Well, either at some point, again, you have to, under the rationale that exists for granting controlling weight deference, which is that the promulgating agency knows the purpose of the rule that it promulgated because it went through the quasi-legislative process. At some point, either the courts or the commission have to look at the promulgating agency's official constructions of its rule.
Well, if it was pointed out to TAC, what makes you think they didn't hear what you were saying?
Well, they certainly didn't mention them, and the entire analysis that they used indicates that they looked at multiple transactions to determine whether the software is taxable, and that's not what the department had done in its official constructions of the rule. In fact, the department had made it very clear in its official constructions that you look at the sales transaction itself between the software vendor and the customer. You don't look at other sales transactions to determine whether that software sales transaction is taxable.
Does your response at all take into account that here the facts are that there were eight prior rulings and published advisories, if you will, of the interpretation? Let me rephrase that question. What, if any, significance does that have on the issue of controlling weight deference and to whom here?
Well, in this particular case, at least at a minimum, at least the three rulings that I previously mentioned directly address the issues that are present in this case. Now, I think at some point, either the commission or the courts have to say, look, yes, the department had officially construed this rule, and if it's not, those constructions are not plainly inconsistent with the language in the rule, and they know the purpose, so therefore we have to accord deference to the department's construction, or else the commission has to say, well, look, we've looked at these, and we've looked at the department's official constructions of its rule, and in our opinion, the department's construction is plainly inconsistent with the rule. But these are pertinent, you know, these are pertinent rulings around points. I'm not saying that just because there are 10 random rulings concerning the rule that the department's ruling should be accorded deference.
I think that the law of deference is a little different, although there are great similarities, depending on whether or not an agency is interpreting a statute or an agency is interpreting its own rule, or a department is interpreting its own rule. If it's interpreting its own rule, we can give controlling weight authority as long as it's reasonable and not inconsistent with the language. When we're dealing with deference to a statute, we consider at times whether or not the department's interpretation has been long-standing. We consider not only the long-standing, you know, the first one was 40 years ago, but we also consider the number of opportunities they've had. And so my question to you is, although we are interpreting a regulation, not a statute, of what significance are those tools, long-standing and number of opportunities to interpret, therefore uniformity of interpretation, which is the underlying policy. How do those elements, which I normally consider in deference to a statute, fit in, if at all, in the analysis of deference to a administrative regulation?
Certainly there have been cases where an agency has construed an administrative rule for the first time, and this court has said, because the agency is construing the rule for the first time, we are not going to accord deference to the agency's construction. And I believe the most recent case is State X Rel Thomas versus Schwartz, 2007 case. But, you know, we're talking about two different agencies here. The department had construed its rule many times in situations similar to this case, and if the rationale underlying controlling weight deference, you know, the rationale for its existence, that the promulgating agency knows the purpose of the rule that it promulgated, if that is to make any sense at all, then the department's prior constructions of its rule have to be considered at some point.
Counselor, in Daimler-Chrysler, we gave deference to LIRC, even though DWD was the one who promulgated the rule that was at issue, correct?
That's correct.
So we gave LIRC controlling weight deference, as the TAC is requesting controlling, or really not the TAC, but the taxpayer is requesting controlling weight deference to the TAC here, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
I want to deal with two things. One, on the issue of deference. If there was no tax appeals commission and the case came directly to us from the Department of Revenue's decision, this court would say that the department's interpretation of its own regulation, assuming that that regulation was in compliance with the statute, would be controlling. Now we put in the Tax Appeals Commission, which, like this court, has final authority. Tax Appeals Commission has less final authority than we do, because we, in at least a state issue, would not be reviewable, but the Tax Appeals Commission is reviewable by this court or by a trial court. So if you put in the Tax Appeals Commission, it would seem to me the argument should be, as to the regulation, that you would treat the Tax Appeals Commission as you would treat this court, namely, and I think that's your basic argument, namely, the Tax Appeals Commission, in interpreting a regulation, looks to whether the department's regulation is consistent, the department's application of its regulation is consistent with the words of the regulation, and is the regulation is consistent with the statute. I understand that to be your position. I understand that we'll hear the other side's position. But regardless of what the deference is, the ultimate issue before the court is what is a reasonable interpretation of this statute, right?
This rule, yes.
Yeah, or statute and the rule. That is the ultimate, because whether you give it great weight deference, you give it due deference, or you give it no deference, this court has to come up with a reasonable interpretation and then compare it with what has happened in the administrative judicial or quasi-judicial tribunal or in the quasi-legislative tribunal. Isn't that right?
I agree.
Okay. So let's talk about the real issue here, namely the reasonableness of these various interpretations. Now, just so that I can understand this case, precisely what did Menasha Corporation pay sales tax on, or use tax? What did it pay tax on?
It paid tax on, the department assessed tax on Menasha's sale of approximately 70 software modules that Menasha had previously sold thousands of times to other customers. And that those modules are called the R3 system.
R3 system, okay. If I went to the corporation, could I pull off the shelf R3 modules?
I don't think so. I think
they won't have them on the shelf because they have everything electronically.
Correct.
But suppose they okay. Can I go in? What are they going to give me? If I buy an R3, what are they giving me?
Well, it's a business application system. One module might do accounting.
Is it going to be a disk?
I believe it's quite a number of.
So it's going to be a lot of disks.
Yes.
Is that what it's going to be?
I believe so. I'm not going to swear that I know exactly, what the software looks like.
And are all customers going to get the same R3, whatever it is?
Yes.
Was the assessment?
But I can't work it. Isn't that right? I can't use it for anything.
You might be able to use it for some very basic functions, but you're not going to pay $5.2 million to use it to perform basic functions.
I'm going to have to do something to fix these up, to customize these, right?
Correct.
All right. $5.2 million times the sales tax, is that what? That's how you get $350,000?
Yes.
Sales tax is approximately 6%.
5.5, yes.
Okay. So that's where you get $350,000. So now Menasha sold this R3. Is that right?
Before you move on, I want to clarify your answer if I can.
But
the assessment for taxes that was made, was that pre or post modification?
Well, The sale is pre-modification. That's the sale on which the tax was assessed.
So the only tax that was assessed was on the pre-modified modules.
That was the $5 million was the charge.
Yes.
But that wasn't just for the disk. That was for the disk as to be modified, correct?
No. I mean, ICS was hired for $13 million to modify the software to accommodate Menasha's specific needs.
So now, SAP didn't do any modifications. They delivered a couple packs of disks, which were installed over 2 days, and that's what they paid $5.3 million for?
70 disks. But
right. It took them 2 days to download them, according to the record. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm not
That's what it was
that.
Paid for. So how much did they spend
know
to
what
modify?
It was, I want to know what it was for. In other words, was there anything... Was it just the raw disk, and that was the end of the sales tax, or was there an obligation by SAP to further modify this R3 when they paid this money?
Well, at page 34 of the commission's decision, the commission found that SAP in the licensing contract, the licensing agreement is in the record, and it's around page 300 of the commission record. It's fairly long, but the commission found that there was nothing in the licensing agreement that obligated SAP to modify the software. Now,
the answer to my question, with all due respect, and maybe you don't know it. Maybe I'm asking a question that just isn't clear from the record, and I respect your answer if you don't know it. What I'm wanting to know is, was the $5.3 million paid just for the tangible personal property, which included whatever number of disks there were, period, end of story, no modifications to them at all, that's it?
No modifications agreed to as part of that transaction. Now, SAP did do some things as part of later sales transactions. Those transactions were not taxed. Those transactions were considered by the department to be sales of services.
Okay.
But
just the personal property, period.
I mean, there are, when software is sold, existing software, I mean, there are typically provisions for maintenance and updates and things like that. But those are not modifications of the software to accommodate the customer's particular
needs. I agree
with
you. So there was no obligation in the $5.3 million to do any modifications at all to this software to make it compatible with Menasha's business?
Not as part of that sales transaction, and that's what I think the commission missed in this case,
okay.
That the sales tax is a transaction-based tax. Mm-hmm. And if I can maybe give an oversimplified example.
Uh-huh.
If I hire a painter and I have the painter paint my walls, that is a non, the essence of that transaction is a non-taxable service.
Mm-hmm.
There's no tax on the transaction. Okay? You look at that transaction, you see what the painter did. It's a service, it's not taxed. If, on the other hand, I go to Menards and I buy the paint, I have to pay tax on that paint because my purchase of that paint, that individual transaction, involves a sale of tangible personal property. It doesn't make any difference that I give the paint to the painter and the painter paints the walls. You still end up in the same place, but you have two separate sales transactions. One of them is a sale of taxable, tangible personal property, and one of them is a non-taxable sale of services. And I think what the commission did in this case is kind of look at everything together and say, well, you know, when we got to the end, Menasha spent a lot of money in order to accommodate this software to its particular needs. And there's no doubt that Menasha did spend a lot of money.
How much?
The budgeting, they indicated they budgeted $42 million, but I think some of that has to be for their own internal costs. But certainly $13 million to have ICS
and
modify the software and some other contracts with
you SAP. Didn't tax for the money.
Didn't tax any of that.
You're only taxing for this tangible R3 that if I had $5.3 million and thought it would be good for me, I could buy.
And if you were a computer genius, you could install it yourself.
I can't install one simple thing myself. So we won't talk about that.
Interestingly, SAP is now, you know, I've seen recently on television, they're advertising their software on television.
Counsel, let me ask you about paragraph 3 of the Court of Appeals opinion. The Court of Appeals indicated in that paragraph that the system is not usable. It first describes the 70 software modules. Each module can provide a rudimentary business and accounting software system for a different segment of a client's business. But then the operative sentence, the system is not usable to a client as sold. It must be modified to fit a client's business operations. Is that an inaccurate statement?
I think it's generally accurate. As I indicated, you could probably use it to perform some basic functions, but you would never pay $5.2 million for software to perform basic functions.
My assumption is the reason somebody buys this R3 system and pays $5.3 million, even if they can't use it immediately, is that it saves them work, computer work, that they'd have to do themselves if they didn't buy the R3. I mean, otherwise, why buy it? It must have some useful function.
Well, I mean, it presumably you don't buy it unless your business is going to run more efficiently after you install the software.
Even if you have to pay another $20 million to get it to work right for you.
Yes.
You have a base there.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of the R3, as I understand it.
Well, I mean, that is true that it provides a base that, you know, needs subsequent modification.
On the deference question, does the Tax Appeals Commission owe deference to the Department of Revenue?
Well, I say yes. I mean, I think that the Tax Appeals Commission at a minimum should be required to do the same thing that a court would do if there were no quasi-judicial decision at all. In other words, if somehow the application of this rule were involved in a court case where there was no quasi-judicial decision, let's say some kind of a liability case, a court would accord controlling weight deference to it. So, I mean, I think that the commission either has to accord controlling weight deference to the department's rule, or else if it doesn't, then the reviewing court shouldn't accord any deference to the commission with respect to the commission's construction of the rule. And the only real issue in this case is the construction of the rule. The statute doesn't really address how software is taxed.
Counsel, let me just be clear. Great weight, due weight, or no deference? Which standard are you saying we should apply to the Tax Appeals Commission decision?
To the Tax Appeals construction of the department's rule, de novo.
No deference.
No deference.
Okay. Thank you.
My time is up. So thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. McGinnity, representing Menasha Corporation.
Thank you, Justice. May it please the Court. I'd like to suggest that I think that the framework that has been offered by the department is off base here. If we look at why was this rule enacted, we need to first understand what was the context of taxation of computer software before the rule was adopted. And this court had decided in the Janesville case, and other courts had decided, and TAC had decided previously, that the issue was, is computer software tangible personal property or is it intangible property, which is key because Wisconsin sales tax applies to tangible personal property, but Wisconsin does not tax intangible property. So that was a key distinction. And all the case law prior to the promulgation of the department's rule had said when somebody's getting software, whether it's on disks, like this was with the modules on disks, or whether we're talking about the old days when it was on cards, the data cards, you're not paying, in this case, $5.2 million for the plastic that comprises the tangible property of the plastic. Nobody's paying $5.2 million. What you're paying for is the intangible intellectual property that is embodied on that vehicle, that medium of transmitting the intangible property. And so this court had made very clear in the Janesville case, it doesn't make any difference how you're transferring that medium. It's intangible. And what happened after that is the department then went to the computer industry and said, this is a problem, because the rule was all computer software is non-taxable. And so the department approached the computer industry. They worked together. This was not just a DOR sitting in its office in the think tank promulgating on its own. This went through the give and take of a compromise. And what industry and the Department of Revenue compromised was to say, we're going to carve out an exception to the court's rule that all computer software is intangible. And the exception is for canned software, the ready-to-use, off-the-shelf. You can go to Best Buy and get Microsoft Excel or Word or whatever it is. Everybody's getting the same thing. And so even though the courts previously had said that's intangible, the deal here or the compromise was to say we're going to carve out the canned software and we're going to make that taxable, and the way that we're going to do that is to call that tangible personal property, even though that would not have met the definition of tangible personal property under the court's prior decisions. And so when you look at Rule Tax 11.71, what you see is that the way this was accomplished was to define two categories, custom and pre-written.
That's in the statute itself.
No, Justice Abramson. What the statute says is it defines tangible personal property to include computer software except custom.
Okay.
The statute doesn't have the pre-written in there.
No, but it does have a definition of what kind of software is going to be tangible property.
Not really a definition. What it says is software will be deemed tangible unless it's custom.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. And so then, that means the department could issue regulations defining, further defining the statute, right?
Actually, it happened the other way around, Justice Abramson.
Okay.
The department, in an effort to overcome the court decisions that were saying all computer software is intangible, the department actually promulgated its rule years before the statute was amended. Back in 1985, the statute wasn't amended to include software as tangible personal property until 1992. But what was happening is the courts and WETAC were saying you can't alter a statute by rule. So just because the department is saying that they're going to treat pre-written software as taxable, you can't do that because the legislature hasn't.
Yeah, the regulation is contrary to the statute.
Right.
Okay, so what happened, now we have the statute revised.
So the statute is revised to incorporate the rule.
Right.
But again, what I think is the important.
The statute is revised that has particular language in it.
It does.
Okay.
And what's important, I think, to remember here is that the purpose of both the rule and the statute is, again, to define this carve-out. What type of intangible software is going to be taxable? There's absolutely nothing in the rulemaking history here, and the department hasn't even tried to point to anything that says the point of either the statute or the rule was to talk about whether there's a single transaction or multiple transactions. And I think the department, quite frankly, has totally missed the point on this. The issue that has...
Let me interrupt you for a minute so that I understand the difference in your arguments. My understanding of your opponent's argument was basically all we're trying to tax is the single transaction of the sale of the software to begin with. That's all we're after. Do you agree that that's all they're after in terms of taxation?
I think that's not correct, Justice Crooks, and here's what I think is different about that. What the department is trying to say is that the focus of the administrative rule is on determining whether all of the bundle of rights and services that a purchaser acquires by virtue of implementing this kind of a enterprise software system, whether all of the bits and pieces of that are acquired in one transaction or multiple transactions would affect the character of the software. And that's where I disagree. The point of the rule and the statute is to look at the character of the software. And the character of the software that is purchased on that $5.2 million worth of disks can be determined at the time of that transaction with reference to what you know has to happen later to make that usable. And I think, Justice Rogan-Sack, you were hitting the nail on the head. Nobody's going to pay $5.2 million for a stack of disks. That was totally unusable. That is an undisputed fact, that it's unusable in that form. What that is basically, in fact, the department itself described this sort of software in one of its releases as it's the shell. It's just it's a basic shell that has to be modified in order for anybody to use it, and the modifications that are made are customized for each individual user. So what you're buying, you know, I think that it's not correct to refer to the purchase of the disks as a purchase of tangible property. That's the question. Is that tangible personal property as defined under the statute? In other words, was that pre-written software, which is ready to use off the shelf, anybody can just use it, or is it custom? And in order to determine if it's custom, you apply the various factors in the rule. Was there pre-purchase consultation? Was there assistance in installing it? Did there have to be training? All of these things are really going to the complexity and the sophistication of the software.
These are the factors that are set forth in 1171.1e.
Right.
Is that correct?
That's exactly right, Justice.
And
Prosser.
So you're saying you look at all of those factors.
Yes.
You don't just look in isolation at the sale transaction itself.
Right. What I'm saying is, The function of the rule in the statute has nothing to do with the issue that the department has raised belatedly, which is somehow focusing on how many transactions do we have. The number of transactions that it takes to implement this is not what dictates and defines the character of that initial software. And what
we're supposed to define it, we're looking for a definitional resolution here under the statute and the rule. We're not looking for a transactional analysis about physically when did the ownership of the property change, correct?
That's exactly right, Justice Rogan-Sack. Yes.
Now, you interpret the statutory language computer program to mean only off-the-shelf computer programs that need no modification for the purchaser to use.
That's correct. And the reason I say that...
You don't have to look at any other factors.
Well, there's a dichotomy in the rule. And the department has acknowledged, finally, in its briefs, that the two categories are mutually exclusive. Software is either custom under the statute and rule, or it's pre-written. And the first five factors talk about how you look to determine whether it is custom. And again, as the Tax Appeals Commission acknowledged, it looks at the extent to how much effort does it take to make it usable for you. And it's kind of a sliding scale. So you're looking and weighing at these quantitative factors. The definition of pre-written is telling you what's the opposite of custom. And it is specifically defined as canned programs. Canned programs, meaning the kind of thing that you can go and get at Best Buy. Anybody can use it.
What, if any, effect do you think the rebuttable presumption has in the fifth criteria under the definition of custom? Because there's a rebuttable presumption. You typically don't find that when you're weighing factors equally and considering them. A rebuttable presumption that any program with a cost of $10,000 or less is not a custom program.
Here's what I would say about that. And there's a difference of opinion between the Tax Appeals Commission and the Court of Appeals on the significance of that, Justice Siegler. But first and foremost, that although Mr. Creron has suggested that, you know, the Tax Appeals Commission just added up the cost and said, well, then it must be custom, I think that really is not at all a fair characterization of the Tax Appeals Commission's very thorough and methodical analysis of all of the factors under the rule. But what the Tax Appeals Commission said is, if there's a rebuttable presumption that a program costing $10,000 or less is pre-written, that is showing us that cost is a factor, and so if you have, you know, a significantly more costly program, that can weigh in favor, along with all of the other factors, of finding that it is custom. And in doing so, the Tax Appeals Commission was focusing on the preface language of the rule, which says we look at all facts and circumstances, including. And the Tax Appeals Commission correctly noted these are not elements that all of which have to be satisfied. They're factors, among others, that should be considered, again, in defining the character of the software that was transferred.
Ms. McGinnity, if I could ask you about the pre-written programs, because you referred to that under sub K, and I think Mr. Creron made this argument in his brief, including programs developed for in-house use or custom program use, which are subsequently held or offered for sale or lease. As I see that, pre-written programs don't include just the canned programs that you can put on the shelf. It includes other types of programs that are pre-written for custom use. And doesn't sub 7 under E deal with that situation? If an existing program is selected for modification, there must be a significant modification of that program. Doesn't 7 refer to the pre-existing 6 under the definition?
I think it's a little different than that, Justice Butler. Here's how I would describe that. First of all, what the department has said is that factors 6 and 7 are these mandatory factors that trump all of the other factors. And so if they fall within 6 or 7, you don't even look at the other factors. And first of all, I will get to your question in a second, but I just want to point out that when the department says that the Tax Appeals Commission ignored its previous rulings, what the department doesn't disclose is that its previous rulings were perfectly consistent with our position here, which is that you have to look at all of the factors. If you look at the PLRs that are in their appendix, you'll see that repeatedly, they're applying all of these factors. There's absolutely no, there are none of them where they're saying we have to look at whether there's a single transaction. They're not saying everything has to happen in one contract. So the real purpose of factor 6 is, as the department acknowledged, when it amended that factor, initially that factor did not have in there or pre-written. It amended it, and it didn't even go through the rulemaking process because it said this is not a material change. All we're doing is clarifying that we have mutually exclusive categories here. Something's either custom or it's pre-written, and then the pre-written ties to its later definition. Now, to get to your question, Justice Butler, I think what Kay is saying is the relationship between sub 7 and sub K is this. Sub 7 is saying, even if you have something that starts out to be a canned program, if you make significant modifications to it to customize it, then it can become custom.
Right.
K is saying just the converse. You could have something that started out as custom for one customer, but then if that same product is commoditized, basically, and sold to others, it could become pre-written. I think that's the relationship between those two factors. But what's important here, I think, is that with respect to 7, the department admitted at oral, you know, although we've heard a lot about what's an existing program and there's been challenges to the Tax Appeals Commission's conclusion that existing program in sub 7 means the same as existing first general use under K, meaning it's talking about pre-written programs. When Mr. Creeran was asked that question at Court of Appeals oral argument, is it the department's position that existing means the same as pre-written? He answered, absolutely. And he said that because that's the drafting history. When the department added that subsection 7, that factor 7, it specifically said the purpose of that was to acknowledge that you could have something that started as a canned program and that could become custom. There is absolutely no support for the department's current position that factor 7 was somehow intended to trump all of the other factors.
Let's look at 7. Do you agree that these 70 modules, if I'm using the right term, are an existing program?
No.
What are they?
And here's the reason, Justice Abramson. Existing program means the same thing as existing for general use, which is in sub 7.
But the usual rule, as you know, Ms. McGinnity, is that if you use different language, you mean different things. If they wanted an existing program existing for general use, they would have said that. I'll agree with you for the moment. If an existing program for general use, and R3 is sold not only to Menasha Corporation, right? Many. Otherwise, they'd go out of business, right?
Yes.
So it doesn't mean that I'm the general user, but it may mean businesses are general users, right?
But the important word there is use, Justice Abramson.
Okay. But look, it then says if an existing program for general use is selected for modification. Isn't that what Menasha did?
No, because we did not start out with an existing program for general use. That's where we quarrel.
What is R3?
R3 is a program which, on the undisputed facts, is totally useless until it has been customized to an individual customer's specifications. It is not only is it not for general use, it's not for anybody's use. It is, as the department acknowledged in one of its earlier releases, it's just a shell. It's a starting point from which the customization is
added.
But
it's something. It has to be something. Isn't it a program, a starting program?
It is intangible property. Yes, which is not taxable, unless it's held for general use, which it's not.
Well, that's not what the statute says. The statute says computer program. Doesn't
say except custom.
Except custom. And 7 says the modification, in order to be custom, is by the vendor. And here, the modification was not only by the vendor, I think the vendor did some, if I understand it, but others. Major modification was not by the vendor.
Well, I would disagree with that.
Okay.
Even assuming, Justice Abramson, that we get to sub 7, and our position is we don't get there, but even if you do, sub 7 does not say that the vendor has to make all of the modifications. It just says it has to make significant. Menasha paid SAP millions of dollars for SAP's consulting work to make modifications. We have detailed in our brief the undisputed record of all of the work. There were 23 different SAP consultants that were involved in implementing this. There were numerous consulting contracts that were for the purpose of configuring this base $5.2 million shell on disk.
Were they more than half?
I'm sorry?
Were they more than half of the total costs of the modification? Were they 30%, 40%? I'll check it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I haven't looked at it from that perspective, Justice Abramson. But I think, again, you know, just to come back to the point about whether you should believe me about what pre-written means is we have the admission from the Department of Revenue and we have their drafting history when they say the reason that they put Factor 7 in there was to allow for customization of canned programs to be tax exempt, not to trump the other factors. So now we go back and look at the reasonableness of the Commission's analysis here. What the Commission did is, as it was obligated to do, was to consider all the facts and circumstances, all of the factors, and 1 through 5, importantly, have all been expressly conceded by the Department. There's no issue of fact that there was significant pre-sale consultation. It was loaded into the the program was loaded by the vendor. It had significant testing, substantial training, substantial written documentation, substantial maintenance support. There again, TAC thought that you could have a converse assumption from cost. Court of Appeals said, not so sure you can, but cost is not the driving factor here. It's all of the work that had to be done to make this usable. And the use of the term for general use in the definition of pre-written is not accidental. Again, keep in mind, the whole purpose of this rule was to carve out an exception to the general rule that software is intangible and therefore not taxable. And the exception that they carved out was for canned software, ready to use. You pull it off the shelf. You don't have to do anything to it. That's clearly not what we had here. Again, the undisputed facts is that those $5.2 million worth of disks were worthless until they customized it. And that makes it custom software. That's the essence of the transaction here was
Counsel, if I can go back to deference for a minute.
Yes.
Which I think is an important part of this case. My understanding is that your opponent says Daimler-Chrysler really doesn't apply because in that situation, the two agencies didn't really have a conflict. Here, there is such a conflict between the DOR and the Tax Appeals Commission. And therefore, Daimler-Chrysler has no real effect here. What's your response to that?
I think that the Department's position would totally emasculate years' worth of authority on the role of TAC, the deference accorded to TAC, the legislature's decision that TAC is the body that reviews the Department's determinations and is subject to judicial review. TAC would be totally irrelevant. If you think about it, you know, I think it's very ironic here that the Department is saying its own constructions are entitled to controlling weight when the law is that their constructions are not even authoritative because they haven't gone through a rulemaking process. And we cited to you the Fort Howard case it's a TAC case in our brief that talks about, for example, technical information memos. And the department here in this case has tried to suggest that a technical information memo from the 1970s, 10 years before this rule was even promulgated, somehow, you know, that TAC had to follow that. TIMs are not even authoritative, much less giving to controlling weight. So if you think about it, we have an adversary process here. I mean, how can a taxpayer ever hope to win if TAC has to give department controlling weight?
If I can follow up on Justice Crook's question, my understanding of Mr. Creeran's brief and where what he was arguing before today was essentially that controlling weight deference should be given to DOR and not to TAC. What I heard him saying today was something a little bit different, and I'd like you to address what I think I heard him saying. Maybe I got him wrong, and if I did, I apologize. But what I think I heard him saying today was, look, TAC should give deference to DOR, and if TAC fails to give deference to DOR, then this court should not give controlling weight to TAC.
And
that's a little bit different than the court giving controlling weight to DOR.
I agree with that. I have not seen Mr. Creron cite any cases that provide any support whatsoever for that very novel theory. And once again, Justice Butler, if TAC has to give controlling weight to the DOR, then why do we need TAC? The whole reason we get before TAC is because a taxpayer disagrees with the department's rule interpretation, and if their rule interpretation has controlling weight, why are we wasting our time in front of the TAC? That is not how the legislature divided responsibilities here. The legislature gave rulemaking authority to Department of Revenue, subject to stringent requirements for public notice and the kind of hearing and the give and take that we had here, but it gave to TAC the final authority for the determination of all questions of law and fact. It doesn't, there's nothing in this, I don't think you can reconcile 73.01 with the suggestion that TAC has to give controlling weight to a department interpretation. I think that's just completely against what the statute says. And the legislature gets to decide. And on that point, I would just emphasize the a point that we made in our supplemental authority filed yesterday. You know, this isn't the first time the department has made this argument about trying to really narrow the exemption for software. It's tried four times to get either rule changes or statutory changes to adopt its position that it's advancing to you today, and it keeps failing. And it failed as recently as 6 weeks ago or whenever the budget bill was passed. There it was specific language that was proposed which would have embodied what they're trying to say here. Basically, the department's position here is that unless you've got software that's specifically written from scratch for a particular customer, then it's going to be taxable. And they tried that, and they tried it again this year, and the legislature keeps rejecting that. So I think that's very important indicia that the legislature doesn't agree with what the department is trying to do. If the legislature wanted to tax more broadly software, it would do so. But again, the purpose of it was to carve out a relatively narrow exception from a general rule that all software is intangible and all software is non-taxable. And this system very clearly does not fall within that relatively narrow exception.
Seems to me that you are having the pre-written program trump everything. If it's not a pre-written program, then it's not taxable.
And that's exactly right, Justice Abramson. And the Department of Revenue has acknowledged in his briefs, in the briefs, we've got two categories. It's either custom or it's pre-written. So if it's pre-written, by definition, it's not custom. If it's custom, by definition, it's not pre-written.
That still leaves the issue of what it means by prepared, held, or existing for general use. Because this R3 has a value. Otherwise, people would not buy it. And more than one company has bought this.
Correct. And the department...
Therefore, it has some use. Okay.
Right.
And therefore was developed normally for more than one customer, right?
That's correct. Okay. But not held for general use. That's the difference.
What does general use mean?
That it's usable off the shelf, that anybody can use it. Again, what the department kept arguing to TAC and to the Court of Appeals is that it really means general purpose. It doesn't. Use is a very deliberate word in the rule that goes to whether or not it's canned software. Can you use it when you buy it? And the answer here is no.
Without modification.
Right. And
so you're adding the words without modification.
Well, I don't think that I'm adding those words. But what does general use mean if it doesn't? Keep in mind that that is a parallel to the word canned. So they're saying pre-written programs often referred to as canned programs. mean this. A CAN program is something you buy, you install it on your computer, you're set to go. You don't have to hire millions of dollars worth of consultants to make it usable. And that we have lots and lots of admissions from the Department of Revenue in this case that this program, as delivered on the disks, not only wasn't usable generally, it wasn't even usable to Menasha.
What does it mean in that sentence, including programs developed for in-house use or custom program use?
Then you have to read the rest of it.
And I know that
which are subsequently held.
Sale.
What I believe that means is, as I was describing to Justice Butler, is you can have both situations. You can have something that starts as custom and it becomes pre-written. If it's customized for a customer and then you take that same program and you mass market it, or you can have something that starts as pre-written and significant modifications are made to it to convert it to custom. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Ms. McGinnis.
Yeah, I do have one question. What exactly did Menasha get for the $5.2 million?
It got the shell, the starting point. It got the disks that were the starting point to create a customized software program that would be company-wide.
Did it get
implemented over a period of, it took them about 7 years to get this in place.
And the tax is only on this starting point.
This tax is on the starting point, right. It's on the piece of the puzzle.
Modules.
This piece of the puzzle. Right. There's no issue about program services because services aren't taxable.
That's right. So the 70 modules, the R3, is the basis that is being taxed.
Correct.
Not any of the modifications, not any of the other issues.
Correct.
But it's still a customized software under your definition because it does nothing until it is modified.
Exactly. Right? That's exactly right, Justice Wiggins.
Thank
Is there any...
Go ahead.
For the $5.2 million, is there any commitment? Was there any... does the $5.2 million pay for any consultation for those 70 modules or any commitment to change the modules afterward?
That particular sum of money does not. If you look at the statement of facts in the department's brief, they point out that the way SAP structured their contracts is they segregated out. They have a license contract that has a license fee, and then they have separate contracts for all of the other work that has to be done to customize it. So there were something like 25 contracts with SAP. The license agreement is just one of them. But they don't mix and match. So they say, here's what you're paying for the license of just the modules, and then they separately contract out. And one of the reasons that they do that, as is evident from the findings, is SAP can't always personally do all of the work. It's a lot of work. And so there were, as I said, 23 people from SAP working on this project, but... SAP told Menasha that it would not have a sufficient consultants to be able to implement this, and then SAP has a list of approved, what they call logo partners, who are authorized to work on this proprietary software and know how to do it, and so you can contract with an approved logo partner to assist with the installation and all of the modifications, and that's what was done here.
You see any... deficiencies in the decision of the Court of Appeals?
The only one I would question is their suggestion that you can't look at high cost as relevant just because it's set out as a rebuttable presumption with respect to low cost. And under an all facts and circumstances test, I think you look at everything. These are not elements that have to be satisfied. They are factors to be considered. And if low cost is relevant, I would suggest high cost is also relevant.
Can you think of any circumstance other than the one you just mentioned that is not in the list that might be considered?
Other circumstances, other factors besides what's here?
Yeah.
Other factors, for example, here are, from the customer's perspective, what does the customer think it's getting? And what the evidence is undisputed. Menasha was shopping for with the assistance of consultants, a customized computer program. It wasn't shopping for a canned computer program. It needed a program that would be customized to satisfy its specific needs given its specific type of programs, how many entities this was going to be across, how many functions they were using. So if we want to talk about this in the language of essence of the essence of the transaction clearly from Menasha's point of view is they were buying custom software. Thank you.
Thank you, Council.
First of all, I don't agree with the historical description of the rulemaking process. I don't agree that the department got together with the computer industry to attempt in the rulemaking process to essentially overrule or get around Janesville data. What happened is the department promulgated the rule, and this court's decision in Janesville data essentially said the rule was a nullity because we're just going to look at whether software is tangible or intangible. Then what happened is the legislature in 1992 overruled that decision and revitalized the pre-existing rule. In 1992, the rule amendment, we didn't not follow the rulemaking process. What we said was because the pre-existing software is already not taxable under the rule, that the short amendment in 1992 didn't work a significant change, and what that meant was that no hearing was required. We certainly went through the process of going to the legislature and amending the rule. I think another thing that's being ignored here is that the definition of custom software in the rule. I mean, the rule says that custom software is software that accommodates the specific processing needs of the customer. The R3 modules are not, as purchased by Menasha, are not custom software within that definition because as purchased, the modules did not accommodate the specific processing needs of Menasha. Menasha hired ICS to customize the software so that it would accommodate Menasha's specific processing needs. Now, as Ms. McGinnity pointed out, it took about 7 years to do that. It was an expensive process, but the reason that the sales tax is a transaction-based tax is because a vendor can't wait 7 years to decide whether to require the customer to pay the tax.
Where does it say, what are you relying on for the definition of custom programs mean accommodate the needs of the customer?
Rule tax 11.711E.
Okay. That's in the first sentence, which no one has looked at yet. Okay. Good. Thank you.
When were the words accept custom computer programs added?
1992, I believe. You're talking about the amendment to the statute.
And when was 1171-1E adopted by the Department of Revenue?
1986.
It preceded the 92 amendment.
Correct.
When did it go to the legislature?
Well, it had to go to the legislature at that time in order to be adopted as a rule, and the TIMS that were talked about by Ms. McGinnity is what were used by the department to determine whether software was taxable before the rule. We didn't skip a number of years between the TIMS and the rule. The rule immediately followed the TIMS.
Mr. Carreron, going to the definition under sub 1E, is there any dispute here that the utility and application software did not accommodate the special needs until it was modified in this case? As I understand, once again, the Court of Appeals opinion said that this is unusable. It can't be used until it's modified. So if I understand this, and we're looking at the definition of custom programs, if you have a program that is not accommodating the special processing needs of the customer and doesn't do so until it's modified, doesn't that fall under the definition of custom programs?
I was following you until you got to the very last part.
I guess the problem that I'm having is I see the disagreement between the parties. You have, on the one hand, you're arguing that, look, what we have here is a CAN program, an off-the-shelf program that was purchased. That's what we're taxing, and all the modifications that were done after that purchase. What I hear Ms. McGinnity saying is, look, we have a program that is unusable until it is modified, and therefore, by definition, it's custom. That's the disagreement.
Well, I mean, it says custom programs mean utility and application software which accommodate the special processing needs of the customer. This software, I agree with you, does not do that until it's modified. Therefore, as purchased, it's not custom.
Because it doesn't satisfy the customer.
Yes.
So it's off the shelf of
uselessness. You could never purchase anything. If I buy your argument, there's nothing I could purchase as a starter for custom software, because if it has to be modified after the purchase, then it doesn't matter. So if you have just the basic shell of the most elementary program and someone pays $10 million for it, it's still not customized.
We're getting back to the question of what is the sales transaction involved and what is the essence of that transaction.
No, I think what I'm getting to is what's the definition of custom programs, because that's what I'm obligated to determine under both the statute and the rule. And I'm trying to find out how I define custom programs. And if I buy your argument, nothing's ever going to fit there.
I guess I'm not sure I'm totally following what you're saying, but if Menashe had hired SAP as part of one transaction to purchase the software and modify it, all as part of one transaction, then the essence of that transaction is the sale of the service, a sale of a service, customized software. If I go to the store, buy some software that I don't know how to install, it may be very difficult to install it. I may have to hire somebody to do that, pay them a lot of money. But that my purchase from the store is a purchase of existing software. It's tangible personal property.
Okay. Even if you have to modify to make it useful.
Yeah.
But how does that take into account all the facts and circumstances that your rule requires us to take into account?
Well, the rule doesn't just – the rule – I mean, you could have said we'll consider all the facts and circumstances and then not put anything else in the rule, which seems to be the way to a certain extent, the way the commission approached the interpretation of the rule. If you say we consider all the facts and circumstances, including certain things that contain mandatory language, such as existing software has to be modified by the vendor, you've got to apply the mandatory language. Otherwise, why put anything else in there other than just, why not just say, just consider all the facts and circumstances?
This argument before.
Well, I think the justice process question, if I might, is that if your position is that any program that can be bought, pre-written program that can be bought, and then changed for each customer. If that's your position, you only needed K it didn't have to do anything else, because anything that didn't fall within K, that is, that it's pre-written, would automatically be customized. So what are the facts and circumstances? Am I making myself? I'm not making myself clear.
I'm not understanding the question.
Well, your position is these modules are in existence, unchanged for anyone to buy them, right? Therefore, your position is that these are not customized, that they are pre-written for use in the business, as I understand it. And you buy them like the paint, and you are taxable like the paint. If that's true, then won't all of the sales fall either within that or outside that? Any sale of programming falls either in K or it doesn't fall in K. Therefore, you don't need all these factors. In fact, was that in essence, or have I made it even more confusing? Don't answer that. All right. We'll stop at that. Unless you have something else.
Let me just say one quick thing about the new authority that was offered yesterday.
Yes.
This argument's been made before in the Court of Appeals. It's the first time it's being made here. But in our brief at pages 13 and 14, responding to the WMC brief in the Court of Appeals, we addressed the issue of the legislature's non-passage of the streamlined sales tax law. And I'm surprised it's been brought up now, because it was brought up in the Court of Appeals and never brought up again until now.
What did you answer?
We indicated that, first of all, it's a broad-based piece of legislation, and you can't, under Consumer Product Safety Commission, a Supreme Court case, you can't read anything into a legislature's non-passage of a broad-based piece of legislation. We also cited various fiscal bureau fiscal notes and memos that indicated that the change was not intended to have a substantial fiscal effect.
Okay.
And I mean, this is the same legislation, although these are older fiscal notes.
Okay. Thank you, Attorney Creeran, and thank you, Attorney McGinnity, for attempting to clarify not only the concept of deference, since we have three stages of it, the department that makes the regulation, the agency that is quasi-judicial, and this court itself. And for discussing what is and is not tangible property relating to computer programming. That concludes our hearing on 04-AP-3239, Wisconsin Department of Revenue versus Menasha Corporation. The court is in recess for lunch until 1:30. Justice Robinsack will talk to the students who are in the courtroom. I will see the students up in room 411, along with our tribal court guests.